from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made this past weekend at Temple Brith Kodesh, when nearly 3,000 people packed the temple to hear prayers in Hebrew and English, to listen to speakers that included Jews and Christians and Muslims, presenting to an audience that was diverse and united in its condemnation of hate and violence. On Saturday, a 46-year-old man shot 17 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. 11 died. The Anti-Defamation League calls it the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in the history of this country. It just so happens that this hour we had scheduled a guest who's in Rochester as a guest of the Jewish Community Center and the Book Festival, the Rochester Jewish Book Festival, now in its 26th year. Norman Ornstein has been a prolific author and a commentator for many years, focusing on politics and, frankly, how to understand what divides our country. The New Yorker once called Ornstein and his co-author Thomas Mann the uber respectables, long respected in Washington and across the country, and their latest effort is a book with E.J. Dionne titled One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. The Times calls it the single most appropriate book for those trying to understand how Donald Trump won the presidential election. Ornstein is speaking tonight at JCC's Hart Theater, but first, he's our guest for the hour on Connections. Norm, it's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Evan.
And also with us is Andrea Miller, the director of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival. How's it been going, Andrea?
It's been going very well.
And what's going on tonight? I mentioned it briefly, but let our listeners know what you've got tonight, Andrea.
Yeah, tonight Norm Ornstein will be speaking, as you said, at the JCC at 7:30. We do still have tickets available, and those are available at rjbf.org or by calling the JCC.
Norm, I certainly wish we weren't talking about the circumstances that we are, but I want to just start with some of your own take on the violence from this past weekend and the calls for either culpability or blame. And I know that that gets difficult. I mean, in The Atlantic, Adam Serwer wrote a piece saying that, you know, normally you cannot blame politicians for the actions of deranged followers. But he says that normally presidents don't praise violent people or defend white supremacy or call directly for violence at rallies. And then he directly connected the mass shooting in Pittsburgh to the president whipping up hysteria over things like the caravan, to which apparently the synagogue shooter had referred to. Do you blame the president for what happened this weekend?
I don't see how you can avoid putting a significant share of the blame on the president. Look, the people who do these terrible things are responsible for their actions. But we know that both the bomber in Florida and the shooter in Pittsburgh were driven, had their worldviews shaped by the rhetoric of the president, the framing of the important issues of the time by the president, but also amplified by Fox News, talk radio, blogs, and others. And so if you look, I saw somebody did a deep dive into the social media feed of this man in Florida, which focused before 2016 on bodybuilding, on some of his own failures in life, and then shifted dramatically to all of the themes that candidate Trump and then President Trump has picked up on. And you see this, of course, with what the stickers were on his van, but all of them also shaped by how he heard about what the president was saying, which is on these other media outlets. And we know from the social media feed of the shooter in Pittsburgh that, and I'm deliberately not using names because I don't want to glorify people, which sometimes happens, that it was this belief that people from the caravan were coming in to destroy his people, which is basically white Americans, white Christian Americans, and put the blame on HIAS, wonderful Jewish social service organization that helps refugees everywhere. And a caravan that has people walking 900 miles from the United States, fleeing horrible violence in Honduras and other places, that to characterize this as a bunch of murderers and terrorists coming in is just utterly irresponsible and a cynical use of the media. And I would add one other thing, Evan, which is it isn't just President Trump. When you look at a tweet put out and then rescinded by the House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, using anti-Semitic tropes. George Soros has become the sort of devil figure here. All of the things, including the language, that Jews everywhere have seen for decades that are used in very deliberate fashion to whip up people. When you see what others have said about the caravan, you realize that the cynical use of fear and division to gain political points coming right from the top, and what the president says matters more than almost anybody else, has consequences. And not to hold people culpable for their complicity in these kinds of things is, I believe, irresponsible, even if you're going to be criticized for it, and even if we agree that these are actions taken by people not under the direction of the president or his acolytes, but people whose own issues emerge when inflammatory language and issues framed in a particular way bring out the worst in them.
There's so much, I think, that sort of intersects with your most recent book, and we're going to talk about that this hour. And listeners, again, this is a wonderful opportunity if you want to explore what Norm Ornstein has written in his recent book and what he continues to focus on and what has divided our country and why. You can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or you can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. So there's a lot to get through. So let me start with some of the things that you've been focusing on recently. You retweeted Bill Kristol's comment that, quote, the president of the United States has a Fox News problem, end quote. Now, I've said recently that I think we need to try to literally wean our friends and family off of cable news as if it is a drug that's killing them if we know they're on several hours of cable news a day. Do you agree with that? And do you put Fox in a special category? Because I was talking about general, and not to say there's not good journalists in cable news. There are some very good journalists in cable news. But I think our country does have a problem.
I agree. And it's all cable news. I would agree with that as well. You know, when we first got cable news, I thought, wow, this is going to be fabulous. If you have 24-hour news, you're going to be able to get in depth into issues and areas and deal with subtleties in a way that a network news dynamic or set of programs can't. And it's proved not to be the case by and large. Instead, it is the desire to keep viewers coming back over and over again, and it's breaking news fonts at the bottom of the screen, sometimes at the top of the screen or in the middle of the screen when there is no breaking news, but it's also a focus more on sensationalism to a significant degree. Now, we've divided into tribal media, it's true, but I see a very sharp distinction between MSNBC and Fox. Fox has an agenda, and in the programming, especially in the evening, but also a fair amount during the day and starting in the morning with Fox and Friends, that is designed to whip up people. And one of the things that I tweet fairly regularly, and Twitter's become a kind of catharsis for me instead of just yelling at the television or at the wall, the entire Murdoch family, including the children who try to stay out of it, have some culpability in what's put on. And you saw just the other day, after this horrific shooting in the synagogue in Pittsburgh, Lou Dobbs and his show on Fox Business has on a guest, it was a repeat, but they deliberately put it on, who talked about the Soros-dominated State Department and the caravan. And Soros has become the kind of figure, along with other people like Tom Steyer, people with Jewish heritage who are brought up over and over again, the Jewish bankers, the globalists, terms that we've seen used before. And Fox has exploited that, and they make money from it, but it is a very dangerous game. Now, I'm not thrilled with any of cable news, and one of the things that I find frustrating with CNN, for example, is that there's a sort of theme in television commentary that it's like the law, that the viewers are the jury, and you have to bring on a defense attorney and a prosecutor, and then the truth will emerge and people can make their judgment. But it's not like the law. What you get is a Trump apologist on one side and somebody, usually a Democratic strategist, as they're called, on the other. I'm not sure what that term even means, yelling at each other. And what people come away with is believing that all politics is at extremes. Or what you get is if you bring on, say, a scientist who says climate change is a real thing and it's man-made, and then you have to bring on another scientist who says, no, it's not. What the public comes away believing is that the scientific community is divided right down the middle when it's divided 99.5 to 0.5. So there's a real problem, I think, just generally with cable news. And thank goodness for national public radio and shows like yours.
Well, that's very kind. And, I think without hyperbole, I think in many ways, there's a lot of people who can especially look at older family members and say, I'm losing them to cable news. I mean, I'm losing sort of their critical thinking. But let me offer sort of a response to some of what you say about agenda. So when you say Fox News has an agenda, in my mind, MSNBC has an agenda, or at least tends to support more left-leaning political causes, whereas Fox News... You might say, well, they support right-leaning political causes. And I don't think they do. I think Fox supports the concentration of power in the political hands of people on the right. And they are a team sport in which winning is what matters. So in MSNBC, it's more about interest in policy ideas, which lean left. And on Fox, it's winning and beating the left, which is different.
I agree with that. I also think that there are some other elements here. On MSNBC, even if there is a left tilt, especially in the evening, although some now during the day, facts matter. And if the facts aren't going your way, there's at least some discussion and a willingness to entertain the reality that it's more complicated. That's just not the case on Fox. I think what's happened is, and it goes back, of course, to Roger Ailes's brilliant business model, which was that you can find an audience on the right that feels grievances. And it goes back decades. And I think it's much more on the right than the left. The sense that the larger establishment and the media have shut us out. And even though they're now a more dominant force, you can play on those grievances over and over again. And you get people coming back over and over again. And you have advertisers who appreciate that. That is significantly different than what we see elsewhere. But it is a willingness to distort reality, not to report news when major news stories are occurring that are not ones you want to hear. Focus on other things. Tucker Carlson is a master at that, for example. But in ways that divide the country for your own gain. And that's different, I think, than others. And I do think the larger reality that you talked about of people getting caught in this, it isn't just Fox or cable news. We do have a problem in this wonderful world where people like you and me and Andrea can have so many sources of information at our fingertips. In an instant, you can find out almost anything. But for lots of others, it's a cacophony. And if you cocoon in on things that make you feel comfortable, which now you can do, because you're not just sitting there the way I was when I grew up with three television channels and no remote control, and you're a passive consumer, now you can actively choose what you want to hear. And when you cocoon in, you develop your own set of facts, and you are not going to be moved from those facts, even if there's incontrovertible and overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And what's happened is, in a broader sense, the danger we have in the society as more and more people move in that direction is that the whole notion of our system of governance that the framers created, where you start with a common set of facts and then you debate and deliberate to reach policy agreement ultimately, goes out the window if you don't have a common set of facts. And that's, I think, a danger, the position that we're in now, that we see, just as an example, overwhelmingly with this caravan. The notion that you have a group of people poised on the border, ready to come over and bring, as Brian Kilmeade said on Fox News just today, horrible diseases and terrible infestations, which is simply not a reality. And people are going to hear that and believe it. And unfortunately, as they hear things like that and believe them, they may take actions that are really bad because they believe they're doing the right thing. You can look at the Pizzagate business. You know, I live in Washington, D.C. The Comet Pizza is a place right next door to the best independent bookstore in, I would say, even in the country, Politics and Prose, a place where people go with their families. And the idea that it was harboring a group of child molesters in the basement was just bizarre. But lots of people believed it because it got repeated over and over again on social media.
Well, and before I get to some phone calls for our guest for the hour, Norm Ornstein, who is in Rochester as a guest of the JCC and the Rochester Jewish Book Festival. He's at the JCC's Heart Theater tonight, 7:30. Tickets still available. Get them, though. If you saw the response around the country to what happened in Pittsburgh, there is unity. There's interest in coming together. There's interest in turning out and hearing voices. And I suspect Norm's event is going to sell out tonight. But he's in Rochester, and that's why he's here. So before I get to some phone calls, a couple of comments from some conservative writers that I'd love to get your take on. First of all, the president returned this past weekend to calling the news media the enemy of the people. And conservative writer Matt Kelly this morning wrote, quote, "Trump is playing with fire with his enemy of the people nonsense. It's utterly dangerous and irresponsible. Republicans should publicly condemn this rhetoric," end quote. But the notion that Republicans are going to do a lot to publicly condemn the president, Molly Hemingway for The Federalist pushes back on this idea that there is a large Never Trump movement. So you do have, so quote unquote, Never Trump conservatives or Republicans, the Max Boots, the Tom Nichols of the world. They exist. They do. But largely public polling, and Hemingway points this out all the time, shows that Donald Trump is approved and liked and supported by the Republican Party essentially as the same as Ronald Reagan was, as George H.W. Bush was, as George W. Bush. There's nothing different about him among Republicans, largely speaking. Now, there are some Never Trump, the Ross Douthats, or I don't even know if Douthats, Never Trump, but there are some prominent people in media, but not really the electorate. So when Kelly's saying, well, Republicans have to do this, Hemingway's saying, you can't tell Republicans to go against this president. He is just a Republican to them, and they're going to support him. Do you agree with that?
There's some truth to that, certainly. I do think that you can also look at this through another prism, which is what Matt Kelly is saying, in effect, is get your moral character back. Get your spine back. The term enemy of the people was originated by Stalin, and he used it to kill large numbers of people. When Nikita Khrushchev became the head of the Soviet Union, he banned the use of the term because it was too inflammatory and dangerous. And now Trump has brought it back. You can look at the electorate and say, yes, Republicans support Trump. And indeed, Republicans change their policy positions 180 when Trump takes particular positions, which itself is a little unsettling. But you can also make the case that that's not conservatism in the traditional way. It's an authoritarian sort of thing. So I agree with Molly Hemingway in terms of the poll results. I'd even take it to a different level, Evan, which is the Never Trumpers are almost all outside government. The fact that so many Republicans in the electorate support Trump means that the Republicans in Congress have completely abandoned their role as a check and balance on the president. And that is more disconcerting to me even than the public acceptance.
Well, the New York Times had a lot of praise for the book that I keep calling it your book, but you know, you co-authored most recently.
Yeah.
And the name of the book is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And one of the things that the New York Times cautions against doing is asking this book or writers like Norm Ornstein, my guest for the hour, to overly distill a complex question. Let me go against them and ask you to try to do that real quick because I want to get to phone calls.
Yeah.
But when we think about the electorate, there is this idea that says, well, what you're doing is you're looking down your nose. You're condescending to people who wanted to break the system. And by God, Trump was there to break the system. But the Times points out that your writing over the years, not just this book, but previous books, has pointed out that, especially over the last decade or so, Trump is kind of a manifestation of what the party has intentionally done, as opposed to going outside it entirely, despite some of the narratives we've heard. Yeah. Why do you say that?
So we have to keep in mind that Trump didn't just emerge from nowhere. He was the product of a lot of these things that have been going on. And if you look at the election in Brazil, which now has a Duterte-like, they call him a populist, but he's really an autocrat. We see seeds of this all around the world. And some of it is the kind of populist instinct that's deep in America's DNA that emerges whenever there are economic difficulties and can last a lot longer. But what I've seen with the Republican Party, and it goes back even more than a decade, it started with Newt Gingrich deliberately tribalizing our politics, moving from partisanship and even ideological polarization to tribalism, which is very different. It's not you're our distinguished opponents who believe different things, but we can work together. You're the enemy trying to destroy our way of life. And frankly, what it amounts to is a party that saw that demographically it was starting to become a minority party. And you have two choices. You have a crossroads. You can either begin to alter not just your rhetoric, but your policies to try and broaden your appeal so that you can actually appeal to a broader electorate, or you can double down on a base and use things like voter suppression and words of division to get your base activated and angry and turning out in larger numbers and then suppress the other sides. Reince Priebus, after the Republicans lost the presidency in 2012, remember the chairman of the Republican National Committee, did this autopsy that basically said we've got to try and reach out to some minority groups. And then by 2016, when he became the chief of staff to Trump, completely abandoned that and they decided to go even further on the politics of division and fear. And this has been building for a long time. It came before Trump. It has been reinforced by Trump. Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy, John Cornyn, all of the leaders of the party, Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who jammed through not just the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, but also now has been holding hearings against all norms and convention during a recess to try and jam through more judges. All of them are complicit in this. No party is angelic. Democrats, you know, politics is hardball. But we have a very distinct difference, and the polarization and the approach is asymmetric. And that's just a reality that I can't avoid.
One more quick point on that before we get to the phones. I think it puts the media in a hard position. If, to the extent that a journalist might agree with your assessment, the journalist still fears the public saying, well, if you point that out, you are biased and you are engaging in team sports. And that's tough for media that wants to remain nonpartisan. I mean, people have biases. I always say there's no unbiased, objective media. We all are human beings with biases. The question is, are you self-aware of your biases, and can you do it in a way that is not necessarily beholden to a team sport or a partisanship? But it gets awfully hard these days when the media is tired of being accused of partisanship.
And understood. And, you know, for decades, as I've been immersed in politics in Washington, I work closely with people from both parties. One of my dear friends, and I dedicated a book to him, was Barbara Conable, who represented the Rochester area for a long time, one of the greatest public servants I've ever encountered. But in 2012, when Tom Mann and I did our book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and an excerpt from it, the day it was before it was published, was in the Washington Post Outlook section, and our editor, Carlos Lozada, helpfully titled it, Let's Just Say It, The Republicans Are the Problem. We had reached a conclusion that it seemed to me was an undeniable one. I mention all that because the pushback we got from many in the media was, hey, we report both sides. And my reaction to that was that a balanced treatment of an unbalanced reality is simply wrong. And what we've seen is journalists are inculcated with the idea that you report both sides. But not every issue has both sides. Sometimes you have many sides. Sometimes there's really one side. Saying that somebody's lied is just not in the DNA of journalists very easily. But it's been a part of the problem that we have. And we're starting to see some inching away from it because now you got people being hit between the eyes with a 2x4 over and over again with a reality, including the reality of what Trump says and tweets every day, but it's still there in a very deep-seated way. And it's hard to get away from it. I'm hopeful that we will. It's not a matter of moving over to just pounding Republicans. It's a matter of looking at a reality and reporting the reality of what's there. And if that reality is that one side or one individual is more to blame than the other, you have an obligation to report not just both sides, but the truth.
Just got a note from a listener who says, Evan, tuning in late, who is this guest? He's now my favorite you've ever had on the show. His name's Norm Ornstein. Norm Ornstein is a prolific author and longtime analyst, and he's in Rochester as a guest of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival. Andrea Miller, tonight people can meet Norm and hear more when?
Tonight, 7:30 at the Jewish Community Center in Brighton, in the Hart Theater. Tickets are still available. You can call the JCC 461-2000.
You want to hear someone who does not think Norm is one of his favorites? It's John in Rochester first. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Norm.
Hey, John.
Norm, I got to say, you bring up some good points that I think, some of these wackos get influenced by rhetoric. But what you don't get at is the rhetoric is on both sides. MSNBC, CNN, I don't know if you watch a lot of that. I do. They are as bad as Fox, or I would say worse than Fox, as far as inciting, calling Republicans or people that voted for Trump Nazis. It's a constant thing. And I'll give you an example. Steve Scalise and the shooting of Steve Scalise, and a lot of the targets were all Republicans, I think 20 congressmen and senators. Was a Bernie Sanders supporter. Bernie Sanders continuously through the campaign just demonized Republicans. And basically, I don't think he called Republicans Hitler, but it was a lot of inciting going on by Bernie Sanders. And this guy was a Bernie Sanders supporter. So I think the blame is on both sides. You're really soft-selling the blame on the left.
All right, so, John, let me just ask you a quick question, and then I'll let Norm respond here. Would you agree with the premise that there will always be some level, some small non-zero number of citizens who, because of political fever, mental illness, ideology, et cetera, will take to violence, whether it's shooting Ronald Reagan, whether it's pick any number of incidents?
Okay.
That was
my initial point.
Okay, so we agree on that. So do you agree that if that's X, the number Y is the number of people who might have been on the edge but became violent when the leaders that they support actually seem to support violence, or occasionally at rallies call for violence or support the kind of movements that endorse violence, the likes of which Bernie Sanders does not do? Do you agree with that?
Well, in Bernie Sanders' case, he was demonizing the conservatives.
He was criticizing.
Right. I can't think of an instance where he called for. Called him Hitler, but.
Okay. Okay. So you say demonize. Okay. Fair enough. Norm, go ahead.
So, let's posit that there are left fringe people and right fringe people.
Yeah.
There are anarchists and nihilists on the left who have promoted violence in different places. We saw some of that in a small way at the inauguration. I'll posit that. I would also say that you are absolutely right, Evan, that Bernie Sanders did not incite people to violence. He used tough rhetoric against Republicans. He did not use the kind of language that provokes violence in the same way.
It was pretty tough, though,
yeah,
I gotta say.
Tough, but, you know, remember, months
tough.
Later, you have somebody who basically went to
somebody on the edge could set him off.
But
it irritated the heck out of me.
But, you know, I would say if you go back and look at political rhetoric over many, many decades, we get tough rhetoric in a lot of places. Ronald Reagan used tough rhetoric. Tip O'Neill used tough rhetoric. Using tough rhetoric about a party and its policies is not the same as using a kind of almost deliberate racism and anti-Semitism.
What about Maxine Waters? and some of the comments she made. Eric Kohler recently said, "We're going to kick the opposition." I can give you so many examples on the left, and I'll tell you, I think there's more examples on the left than the right.
Well, Mike Black, do we have the Hugh Hewitt comment? So if you want to try to draw equivalency to what you just heard John say, Hugh Hewitt on MSNBC, while talking to Stephanie Cutter, had this to say. You're going to hear Stephanie Cutter first and Hugh Hewitt saying that he sees the same equivalencies that the caller John does. Let's listen.
There is no equivalent in the Democratic Party.
There is an equivalent. There's the man screaming at Mitch McConnell in the restaurant. There is Maxine Waters
screaming
encouraging people.
Which violates
18 U.S.C. 351. If we go back to the statute.
We can talk about that, but we're talking about the President of the United States. Are you saying you don't agree that this man...
Well, so let's just make one other larger point here, John, which is... The president of the United States is different from anybody else. The president is a figure who is listened to by people, and the words of the president carry a weight that is different from everybody else. I would also say even first ladies at times have done that. When Betty Ford talked about her alcoholism, it had a huge impact on large numbers of people. When she talked about breast cancer, which she had, millions of women went and got mammograms, which they had not done before. People pay attention to what presidents do and say in a way they don't for a candidate, a senator, a House member. And what we have is a president using the kind of language that justifies behavior and that brings people out of the woodwork in a way that we haven't seen before. When the president said after the Charlottesville march, there were many fine people on both sides, and we had literally neo-Nazis there saying and chanting, "Jews will not replace us," and the people he was talking about were marching alongside them with torches. That is a very different phenomenon, and it takes people, and we have always had dark corners in American society, people who believe horrific things, sometimes people who act on them, those who are unstable, but they're in the woodwork until somebody brings them out of the woodwork, and this is a different phenomenon. And to go to Maxine Waters, one out of 435 House members, and some of the things that she said, I would not agree with in the slightest way, and I would not like. But when you have a president who at every public rally talks about an African-American office holder as somebody with low IQ, that is the kind of language that brings out and evokes deliberately racism. When you talk about George Soros and bankers and globalists, which every Jew around the world has seen going back to the 1930s and before.
Globalist as a dog whistle?
It is a direct dog whistle. And Steve Bannon has almost said it, and that's what's been used. This is a trope. And these tropes are bad when they come from anybody, but they're much worse when they come from the president of the United States. And here we have a president who I think has behaved in a fashion different than any other we have had at least in our lifetimes, and I would say going back much further.
Andrew in Irondequoit, next on the phone with Norm Ornstein. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, Norm. Yeah, yes. Donald Trump is really quite a piece of work. Hey, look, you had a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and people wanted to go, you know, back. How can I say this? People looked past like they did with the Clintons and stuff. They looked past all of the, you know, dirty laundry, so to speak, of Donald Trump, and they're worried about their wallets, and they don't like to be overtaxed and overregulated, and that's so. If you want the Democrats to run the country again, I would, if you have any influence, Norm, you might want to write articles about don't talk about over, you know, taxing too much and regulating everybody out of business again. Norm, people are worried about their wallets. They can look past stupid Donald Trump and stupid Hillary Clinton and all of her stories that don't make any sense. Does that make sense to you, Norm?
Andrew, that's a good point. And one of the things we have in the book is there are real grievances and issues out there. They're not all economic ones. And I think a good part of Trump's appeal was a large group of people, and it's there not just in red states. It's in every state. There is a sharp division that we're seeing in the society between those living in metropolitan areas that are managing to not just cope but thrive in the global economy. There's higher education. There's a suppleness there. And as you move out towards smaller cities and towns and then towards rural areas, there's much less of that ability. And the sense that people have had that the intellectuals and the political elites have looked down on them and have ignored them and have, as they've struggled, have not moved forward. And the financial crisis of 2008 and its aftermath reinforced all of that. Trump talked directly to those people. And even if he takes actions that are not in their economic interest, which is what's happening, these tariffs are destroying a lot of lives. Coal jobs are not coming back in the same way. But people believe that he is respectful of them, even if some of the reality isn't there. And if Democrats aren't able to focus on some of these greater concerns, and that includes not a focus on white working class people, all working class people who do what we expect them to do, work 40 hours a week and do what the society asks. But the social contract in return says you're going to have a house to live in, you're going to have food to eat, you're going to be able to educate your kids. And if we aren't fulfilling that social contract and finding ways to do it, then both parties are going to have more difficulty. So I certainly agree that Democrats have to pay attention to those things. Now, we're going to get a real test over whether people who felt overregulated are going to feel underregulated, as we've seen an enormous number of regulations, including on worker safety, for example, on toxic waste just blown out of the water. Now we're getting these private universities back that have preyed on people and taken their money and given them nothing for it. And we have an education department that's basically letting them run rampant with no controls. So whether we can reach a better point of balance in terms of what we regulate and how, Democrats have to be sensitive to those things. And there is a real challenge looking towards the 2020 elections to see if candidates are going to be able to find that sweet spot.
Some Democrats, some members of the media are sort of stuck in this perpetual waiting for the, oh, well, this will do it to Trump. He's now he will lose people. He said John McCain was a loser because he got captured in the campaign. Well, he's going to lose it. This will be the gaffe that does it. And I think what we have seen is there is a portion of the electorate that is so disaffected by economic pain and job loss. And as you point out in your book, that's one category. There's xenophobia, there's racism, and that's real. And that's exploitable. But there is some part of the electorate that just wanted to break the system so badly, that hated this system, Republicans and Democrats as they saw it, that Trump was the answer to that, that irked people. And every time he goes outside of the norm, he just continues to irk and annoy people or frustrate and you sort of befuddle people. And that they delight in that, even if their lives aren't getting better. And they're going to keep voting for him, I think.
There's no doubt about that. You're absolutely right. There are, even if the reality of his draining the swamp is bringing in a group of larger alligators, but this sense that the people who've been in power are frustrated as hell by Trump and are on the defensive or are going after him delights a lot of people who felt like they were left out. And that, more than even their economic self-interest, does resonate. Now, what we are seeing is that at least some of the people who voted for Trump, and in particular suburban women, are turning in a different direction. We're going to have an opportunity as we see what happens on November 6th and then read the tea leaves afterwards to see how much difference that will make. The fact is that the House districts that Republicans are in danger of losing are far more concentrated in suburban areas where those voters can matter. We saw it with the Connor Lamb election in Pennsylvania, the special election in a very Republican seat that a Democrat won. And we'll see how much difference that makes. But, of course, exactly what you said about the people sticking with Trump will matter a great deal with Democrats up as senators in red states where the larger reality is that they're going to react to this tribal identity, and it puts a number of people in jeopardy.
And again, some listeners are going to say, I'm starting to sound like a Trump apologist, but I will say, when people will say, how did these voters keep supporting Trump? How would they vote for him in 2020 if their lives didn't get economically better? I think they have given up on economic improvement in many ways and in many communities where they've been sort of hollowed out by job loss and economic concentration. And if Trump didn't do it, well, damn, the other parties won't either. And at least he annoys them. And he's our guy, and maybe he'll pull it off, or they'll blame someone. And to some degree, you have to understand how deep that economic pain is. Now, putting that aside, you want everyone to sort of also grapple with racism and xenophobia that comes up a lot in Norm's book that he co-authored that I think everyone thinks you ought to read. So, but I think it's going to be very hard to beat him. And there's no value in this stuff, but I'll just ask you briefly, do you think he wins in 2020?
I'm not even sure what other events we're going to see happen in the next 2 weeks.
I mean, the world changes every week.
But look at what happened just over the course of this last week.
Yeah.
And we could end up with wars. There are lots of things that can happen that can alter the political landscape. The Mueller investigation, what might happen if there is a Democratic House that will begin to subpoena documents, tax records, and the like. Lots of things can happen. But you cannot say if we are not in the middle of a depression and if Trump is still president, you have to admit that his chances of winning re-election are reasonable. There is a core to support him. I would also say that if Republicans continue to hold both houses of Congress, and given what's happened with the courts, that we're going to see more ability to suppress the votes of those who would vote for Democrats. We may see more of an opportunity for Russians and others to intervene in our elections. And that could turn an electorate that actually has a majority of people pretty strongly against Trump into one where he can still win re-election. And the nature of the Electoral College is such that two out of the last five elections, the winner of the popular vote lost the presidency. Trump could lose the popular vote not just by the 3 million that he lost to Hillary Clinton, but by 6 million the next time and still win the presidency as well. And that is a danger in terms of the fundamental legitimacy of the system, but it also gives him some additional leverage potentially in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wrong about everything, but I think he wins again at this point. We'll see. Let's do this. Let's squeeze in as many phone calls and emails as we can. And before the hour's out, I do want to ask Norm Ornstein, what do you think the path forward is? Because, you know, you've been covering political divide for so long, so we will hit that. I got an email from Herman in Brighton who says, will there be tickets available at the door tonight, Andrea Miller?
I would strongly encourage you to call the JCC now. When we sell out, we sell out. So 461-2000, give them a call. You can buy over the phone.
John wants to know, what is Norm's opinion of Keith Ellison, who's second in charge of the Democratic Party? He is an ally of the anti-Semite Louis Farrakhan.
And I wish that Keith Ellison had strongly denounced Farrakhan. I know him. I'm from Minnesota. And he's a very bright and talented man. I'm not at all sure, in part because of his political views, but also some personal issues that have emerged during the course of the campaign. He's running for attorney general of Minnesota, which would leave him in a stronger position down the road as somebody representing the left of the Democratic Party. But in a year where Minnesota is going very strongly blue, he's in big trouble, and there are reasons for it.
And Farrakhan, what would you say about Farrakhan?
Farrakhan is an unregenerate anti-Semite who ought to be just simply denounced.
Okay, fair enough. Andy in Rochester is next on the phone. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi, welcome to Rochester. And hey, I just wanted to relate something that happened on social media and Facebook last week. I look at Facebook all through the day and for various reasons, but I have cousins that are from Rochester, but they live in Pittsburgh, PA, and I love them. And I call them super Catholics. We all grew up Catholic, and I don't consider myself any religion now, but I love these people. But I noticed last week they were being whipped up into a big lather by Fox News, Sean Hannity, the president, and over this Mexican caravan. And I was watching all through the day for like 10 hours, all the different things. Friends of theirs, different relatives are chiming in, and these are people I love. And I was like, man, they go around as super Catholics, but everything they're saying is so ugly. I couldn't believe it. So that day I went out to a bar and had two beers. And when I came home at midnight, I thought I'd chime in. And I basically said, I find it really amazing that you guys are following the words of a president who, who somehow claims this is their land, white Christian people. And I said, somebody who doesn't even really follow any religion, me and people like me, follow more in the steps of what Jesus would do. And I thought, and I said, I think it's really shameful that you think these people are coming here to harm us, when in fact they're escaping an ugly place and they're coming here asking us for our help. And I pointed out how the president, who nobody in his entire family going back 200 years has ever served in the military, it looks like him and his son-in-law, they don't pay federal taxes.
So, Andy, let me just jump in and ask you, did you make a dent with your family?
So after I put this on, 2 minutes later, a husband of my cousin, who was in the Pittsburgh police force, came on there and he called me hateful, ill-informed, and all sorts of stuff. So that's going to make Thanksgiving pretty hard. And I did serve my country, and I was in a war zone. And the only reason I'm saying that is I pointed out to them that 95% of us have never been in the military. You don't have to be, but I don't want to put this in a polite way. Chris Rock once said that the only thing that you did for America was you dropped here out of your mom.
Well, I got to jump in, Andy, and let Norm respond to some of that. Go ahead, Norm.
Let me just talk for a minute about the caravan. Mm-hmm. And first, most of these people who are coming from Honduras. They had a contested presidential election, and since then there's been an enormous amount of violence, including gang violence. There are people being killed indiscriminately. And what you have is families walking hundreds of miles through dangerous territory to escape that kind of violence. Now, you don't have to want open borders and recognize you need some ability to determine who comes in or who doesn't. But the fact is there are centuries of international law, and we abide by that international law about people who apply for asylum. And what we have here is a group of people who want a better life, who believe America could provide them with a better life. What we've done in response before the caravan, separating families, taking away children, deliberately establishing a policy so that those families would not be reunited in many cases, putting them into conditions that were absolutely horrific, is, I would say, the antithesis of what American values are supposed to be. And the idea that this caravan is being used as a ploy to suggest that these are a bunch of evil people coming to bring pestilence or crime to America is beyond the pale. And that people who are hearing about it, starting with the president, but moving on down through the kind of media sources that we're seeing, including on Fox and Friends just today, and believing all of this, it does play into a kind of xenophobia that has a long history in America. Remember that Abraham Lincoln, in part, reacted against the Know-Nothing Party, which was against bringing Catholics to America. So Catholics, Jews who saw the St. Louis bringing refugees from Germany turned away, and most of them perished when they got sent back to Germany. But all Americans who came from immigrants ought to be more sensitive to this. You got to have a balanced policy, and there isn't an easy way of dealing with it. But to use it as a political tool to win an election, I just find is reprehensible.
So give me about 2 minutes or less on what you want America to do now, as you've seen all this divide.
So, you know, one of the things about our book, as we wrote it, was deliberately trying to be a little bit optimistic. It's a hard thing to do these days. But we have seen a lot of people in civil society jolted by what they've seen. This is not politics as usual. This is not a society operating as usual. These divisions can work even in America to drive us apart and into sectarian warfare almost. And we have lots of people, I think, who are starting to emerge and fight back against that. And the fact that just last night in Rochester, there were 3,500 people who showed up at a vigil from, I think, across the spectrum, that's happened everywhere in the country. that we're seeing a violence occur, a violence, if you go back to the horrible killings at the church in Charleston, to the two people killed, African-Americans killed in Kentucky, and more would have been killed if this horrible person had been able to get into the church while that service was going on, to what happened in Pittsburgh. I think we have an opportunity here to begin to separate out that small core of people who really are harboring evil values from the rest of the society to seeing that we can't go on in this direction.
And then 30 seconds from within the system, does someone like Senator Ben Sasse get credit from you for wringing his hands about it, or does he have to do more to get the credit?
So I know Ben Sasse. Jeff Flake has been a longtime friend of mine. Bob Corker has as well, and Susan Collins. And my reaction is, words are not enough. You are in a position, especially if you're a senator and a 51-49 Senate, to change things. You could change the behavior of this administration. You could say, I'm not voting for any judge coming out unless you altered the child separation policy, just to pick one example. And you've got enough power to block all of that from happening, to force action. Not one action by any of them. And that, I find, is just really, really horrible.
The book is called One Nation After Trump. Thank you for spending an hour with us here today.
It was a real pleasure.
And your busy schedule, Norm Ornstein. Tonight, Andrea, tell us what's coming up tonight.
Tonight, Norm Ornstein will be speaking at the Jewish Community Center at 7:30. Tickets are available online and by calling the JCC.
And the book festival, Andrea said before the hour began, she said, the festival's largely done. You've had a great one. But to learn more about what you're doing, online where?
RJBF.org.
RJBF.org.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here as
Thanks, Evan.
Our thanks to Randy Gorbman, Mike Black, whole crew helping out behind the glass today. Engineering, Megan Mack is the outstanding producer of Connections. And I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.